Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. In my radio program, I did a two-part series entitled Postmodernism versus God. And in this YouTube, I'm somewhat combining both of those radio programs into a single YouTube. You've probably heard of the term postmodernism. It's an ideology, it's a philosophy of life, it's a term describing the current worldview in academia, and it's also the practice of the average Joe on the street. These ideologies work themselves into the entire culture. And we need to understand the Cretans and the Philistines if we're to reach the Cretans and the Philistines. Not that we would overemphasize our need to understand the culture, to reach the culture, because the biblical message of sin and of righteousness and salvation is timeless for every age and every culture. But in our evangelism, it is helpful to be able to explain to non-Christians, this is what the world is telling you today, but this is what the Bible teaches. It's helpful to contrast the current worldview, what people are telling the world, with God's message. The world is telling us that there are no absolutes. God says there are absolutes. The world is telling us that we are to find our identity in our race, in our ethnicity, in our sexual behavior. God is saying we need to find our identity in Him. The world is telling us that values and morals are made up human constructs, made up by people to get power and to oppress others. God is saying that He made up those values and morals for our good, to oppress our sinful tendencies. The world is saying that we need to be affirmed. God is saying that we need to repent and be saved. Notice all of the words I just used. Absolutes, identity, affirmation, human constructs, oppression. Those are some of the words the devil is now using to sell his lie. And we should know how those terms are being used in order to expose the lies. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 11. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. Consider also the biblical concept of preparing the way of the Lord. I've been thinking about that this week. Luke chapter 1, verse 17 speaks about the prophet John the Baptizer, who preached in Israel right before the arrival of Jesus. Luke 1, 17, it is he who will go as a forerunner before him in the spirit and the power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers back to the children, and the disobedient to the attitude of the righteous, so as to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. This is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, that a prophet would come to prepare the people to receive the Messiah. Malachi chapter 3, verse 1, behold, I'm going to send my messenger, and he will clear the way before me. Or Isaiah chapter 40, a voice is calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed. Malachi chapter 4, behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. He will restore the hearts of the father to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, so that it will not come and smite the land with a curse. So here's a point that we often overlook in evangelism. People have to be prepared before being introduced to Jesus Christ. In my Sunday morning messages, I'm doing a series on the book of 1 John. And I noticed that John begins by stating the first distinction between the Christian and the non-Christian. The non-Christian says he has no sin. The Christian confesses his sin, agrees with God about his sin. And it occurred to me that one of the reasons why evangelism in America is producing such little results is that our culture no longer believes in sin. We take many of these basic theological concepts for granted, and we fail to see that these foundations are being eroded. People who have been taught in education, in entertainment, in law, in politics, that there's no such thing as sin, are people who are not prepared for the Lord. They don't need a savior because they don't see there's anything to be saved from. They've been taught from K to 12 to think positively about themselves, to believe in themselves, to accept themselves for who they are. They've been taught that what is natural is good. And so we wonder why, for all of our efforts, people have very little interest in the gospel. Well, the Bible teaches that the gospel will only be received if people are prepared, if they have embraced certain fundamental truths. And that's why in some places in the world, the gospel is so readily embraced, because the people have certain fundamental attitudes necessary as a prerequisite to receiving the gospel. Prior social beliefs that maybe even the Christian missionary doesn't even understand or see. I mean, he's blessed by seeing all of these conversions, and he might even think that these conversions are because of his own technique. But the explanation is that this is a people group that has been prepared. They believe in sin. They believe in accountability. They have a fear of the Lord. They have respect for authority. Their hearts have been humbled by work. And these are some of the foundational beliefs I'm referring to. So don't underestimate the role of parents and teachers and social leaders to prepare souls to receive the gospel by teaching them these values that are in sync with the Christian worldview. So when the prophet John the Baptizer preached in Israel, how did he prepare the people for Christ? Well, the scripture says that he preached a message of repentance. So in order for the Messiah to be received, the Jewish culture at that particular time needed their self-righteousness taken down and needed a renewed sense of personal sin. Lest, as it says in Malachi 4:6, that the Messiah would come and smite the land with a curse, and no one is saved. Well, in fact, the Messiah did come and smite the land with a curse. Matthew 23:38, he said about Israel, "Behold, your house is left to you desolate. But if it were not for the prior preparation, then even less would have been saved at the day of Pentecost when the early church was formed in Jerusalem." So that's kind of a long introduction. The bottom line is that today, the false ideology we're up against is postmodernism. And if we're to prepare hearts to receive Christ, we must, as Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 10, destroy speculations and every lofty thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And the speculation and the lofty thing that is raised up itself against Christ is postmodernism. So, in brushing up on postmodern thought, I've been reading Stephen Hicks' classic book, Postmodernism Explained. Hicks is a philosophy professor at Rockford University in Illinois. He leans conservative, but he's not a Christian. And as a non-Christian, he doesn't fully know how to explain the whys and the wherefores of postmodernism. He doesn't see postmodernism as a defense mechanism by the unsaved, a defense mechanism that they're now using in a rebellion against God. That's something Christians need to supply to the discussion. But it is interesting to see how Hicks does try to explain postmodernism. He sees it as a lack of reasoning ability. He sees it as a ploy for political power. And all of those things are true. But at the heart, it really is a way to justify rebellion against God. And until we understand that, we're never fully going to understand this movement. So let's cover the movement by answering some basic questions. And the first question is, what is postmodernism? Well, it's a belief that there are no absolute values. It's the abandonment of truth. Truth is whatever you want it to be. The liberalism of the 17th century, the Enlightenment, rejected biblical revelation, but at least they believed that there were absolute truths that man needed to follow. Truths that could be found by reason and logic and natural law. But modern philosophers have carried atheism to its logical conclusion. Without God, there can be no absolutes. There can be no truth. Hicks begins, "By most accounts, we have entered a new intellectual age. We are postmodern now. Leading intellectuals tell us that modernism has died and that a revolution era is upon us, an era liberating us from the oppressive strictures of the past. There has been a changing of the guard." So what are we being liberated from in postmodernism? Requirements? Laws? Any value that is offensive to the depraved sinner? Any value that comes from reason, logic, tradition, or natural law? Postmodernism is not usually a label that people wear. We don't usually hear people saying in academia and politics, "I'm a postmodernist." People will often wear the results of postmodernism. They'll say, "I'm a feminist," or "I'm a socialist," or "I believe in gender liquidity." Postmodernism is the ideological foundation, the excuse or the justification for all of these isms. It's a worldview that supports these isms, these lifestyles. You know, because God made us rational human beings, we like to have justifications and reasons. We want to make sense of why we do what we do, even if we have to lie about reality to justify our actions. Well, this brings us to the second question. Why do people believe in postmodernism? Hicks writes, "Any intellectual movement is defined by its fundamental philosophical premises. Those premises state what it takes to be real, what it is to be human, what is valuable, and how knowledge is acquired. That is, an intellectual movement has a metaphysics, a conception of human nature and values, and an epistemology." And this is what postmodernism seeks to accomplish, a basis for a political lifestyle choice. And Hicks provides a list of some of the things postmodernism seeks to accomplish. Postmodernism asserts that the great books of the West are narrow, exclusive, and intolerant, that Christopher Columbus was not a hero, but an insensitive, smugly superior point man for European imperialism, that the United States is not about liberty and opportunity for everyone, but is sexist, racist, and class-bound, that people shouldn't be judged as individuals, but according to the group they belong, that life in the West is empty, that businesses are exploitive, and that science and technology are also exploitive. Hicks writes, "Postmodernism then becomes an activist strategy against the coalition of reason and power. Postmodernism seeks not to find the foundations and the conditions of truth, but to exercise power for the purpose of social change." He writes, "The task of the postmodern professor is to help the student spot, confront, and work against the political horrors of one's time." And so what are allegedly the political horrors of our time? Well, for the postmodernists, it is traditional values and morality, work, accountability, the things that this spoiled generation despises. And the reason for postmodern professors teaching that values are human constructs is to justify the criticism of those values. The Marxist professor attempts to establish that property rights and family values and gender norms were just made up by powerful people to oppress others in society, those who threaten the order of society. And the reason these leaders wanted order in society is allegedly so that they could use this order to gain power for themselves. You know, the rich needed the values of land rights in order to control, and fathers needed the laws of family in order to control the women. And allegedly, all of these values were made up to persecute racial minorities, women, and the sexually deviant. And if you think about it, without a belief in God, what other reason could there be for all of these social values, these traditions that we have been raised with? And if you want to do evil, if you hate the family, if you want to live off the collective, if you want to be sexually immoral, you do feel like all of these traditional values were made up to oppress you. You may even feel that the concept of God was created to oppress you. So the basic tenets of postmodernism are quickly embraced by some people. The godless student hears these criticisms of Western values and often immediately thinks to himself he has finally come upon the truths that he's always been looking for. And let me point out that it doesn't take a degree in philosophy to become a postmodernist. It doesn't take reading Foucault or Nietzsche. All it takes is for a freshman English teacher or a psychology 101 teacher to point out that the family and the traditional roles of men and women were made up by people, made up by the powerful to oppress the weak. And then the student begins to see the world through the lens of the oppressor versus the oppressed, rather than seeing the world through the biblical worldview that there is a God and we are sinners and we need to conform to the law of God. And the student, under the teaching of postmodernism, begins to see traditional morals as actually hurting people, as being the problem of this world. Hicks gives a really telling example. He cites Kate Ellis, a radical feminist and a professor. She writes in Socialist Review that capitalism and sexism go hand in hand, and that to achieve equality between the sexes requires the overthrowing of existing society. But she finds she has a problem when she tries to teach these themes to her students. She finds that they think like liberal capitalists. They think in terms of equality of opportunity, in terms of simply removing artificial barriers and judging everyone by the same standards. And they think that by personal effort and by ambition, they can overcome most obstacles and achieve success in life. But this means that her students have bought into the whole liberal capitalistic framework that Ellis thinks is dead wrong. So Ellis writes that she will enlist deconstruction as a weapon against those old-fashioned Enlightenment beliefs. If she can first undermine her students' belief in the superiority of capitalist values and of the ideas that people make or break themselves, then their core values will be destabilized. Pushing relativism, she finds, helps achieve this. And once their Enlightenment beliefs are hollowed out by relativistic arguments, she can fill the void with the correct leftist political principles. And so then, when you and I witness to these millennials, we wonder why they resist the gospel. Well, because if you probe deeper, you discover that they have been taught that we are the evil oppressors. We are the value-based conservatives that their professors warned about. And Christians are the problem with this world. We're the oppressors, we're the hate mongers, we're the haters of the human race. And so our generation is not a people prepared for the Lord, as it says in Luke chapter 1, verse 17. Our generation is a people prepared for the Antichrist. Revelation chapter 13, verse 8, all who dwell on the earth will worship him, the Antichrist. And when the Antichrist arrives, along with his government and his ideology, he is not going to have to work very hard to win converts. The world, in its current apostasy from God, will accept him gladly. Now, Hicks writes, postmodernism offers a consistent framework of premises with which to situate our thoughts and our actions. And we can add that this framework is quickly embraced by the ungodly because it supports their innate rebellion against God. A third question I'd like to answer, and one that is posed in Hicks's book, is why is postmodernism collectivism? In other words, why does postmodern philosophy, this philosophy of relativism, always support the political left's desire for a powerful socialistic communist state? It always pushes for Marxism. If postmodernism was really relativism, and there is no truth, we would expect to see conservative and liberal postmodernists. And in the words of Hicks, you would expect to find that postmodernists represent a roughly random distribution of commitments across the political spectrum. Hicks writes, "If values and politics are primarily a matter of a subjective leap into whatever fits one's preference, then we should find people making leaps into all sorts of political programs. But this is not what we find in the case of postmodernism. Postmodernists are monolithic, far left-wing in their politics. Postmodernists are most likely to be hostile to dissent and debate, the most likely to engage in ad hominem arguments and name-calling, the most likely to enact political correct authoritarian measures, and the most likely to use anger and rage as argumentative tactics." Hicks then goes on to explain that the reason postmodernists are all Marxists is that the philosophy of postmodernism is simply a tool or a justification for power. It's a mask for a political agenda. Postmodernists appeal to subjectivity and irrationality as their only means to push for socialism. And Hicks explains this conclusion by showing that in the 20th century, experience has debunked socialism. It's a proven fact that every socialistic communistic nation has ended in technical and financial ruin. And socialism always ends in oppression. Quote, "From the Manifesto of the Communist Party in 1848 to the revelations of 1956 was over a century of theory and evidence. The crisis for the far left was that the logic and evidence was going against socialism. You feel that socialism is true. You want it to be true. Upon socialism, you have pinned all of your dreams of a peaceful and prosperous future society and all your hopes for solving the ills of our current society, but it's failed. This is a moment of truth for anyone who has experienced the agony of a deeply cherished hypothesis running aground on the rocks of reality. What do? Do you abandon your theory and go with the facts, or do you try to find a way to maintain your belief in your theory?" Hicks writes, "Here then is my second hypothesis about postmodernism. Postmodernism is the academic far left's epistemological strategy for responding to the crisis caused by the failure of socialism in theory and in practice." So Hicks sees postmodernism as a tool to justify the failed theory of Marxism. Since evidence and logic refute Marxism, postmodernists attack the whole idea of evidence and logic. They want communism, but they cannot prove it logically or experientially, so they turn to non-reason. They say that feelings are deeper than logic. Another quote from Hicks. "Postmodernism justifies the leap of faith necessary to continue to believe in socialism." Okay, I'll buy that. From a biblical point of view, logic, reason, experience always favors God and God's truth. To break away from God, you have to suppress the mind and the conscience and the experience of history But Hicks never answers the deeper question of why these people are so committed to statism, to collectivism, to Marxism. Yes, we know their justifications, but why the cause? Why is the group emphasized over the individual? Yes, it has something to do with power. Truth is rejected so that they can enrich or empower their own group. But, you know, if you think about it, a lot of socialists will never get into the place of power. What's really going on here, and I think much of this is on the subconscious, is that for the atheist, collectivism solves many problems. You need a God to provide security and purpose and meaning and a future. And without God, the state must become God. There's power and security in numbers. This is a trust in man, a trust in the flesh. So the human race, represented by the government of man, becomes the number one value. And add to this, the ungodly man's hatred of accountability, responsibility, and work, the economic and social freedom in the West means I am responsible for myself. I am accountable for my own work and my own character. I cannot leech off of others. At the very least, I am my own safety net. And without God and the confidence in God's support, socialism becomes very attractive. It is so attractive that the leftists would rather have less wealth and less freedom as long as they have security and less accountability. And as long as they can stick it to the people who play by the rules. And then you add to this mix the leftist disbelief in human sin. This naive assumption that when people get into power, the state, they're going to be altruistic. So you put all this together and that's the yearning for socialism. And this is why the left is for the philosophy of postmodernism. Because it's the only way to support Marxism, and Marxism is their substitute for God. Now, this is not something that Hicks brings out. This is something that I'm adding to the discussion here. Now, a fourth question I'd like to answer, and we only really have time to look at four questions, is why is postmodernism contradictory? Conservatives tend to go after postmodernism on this point, that postmodernism is very inconsistent. You've probably heard this often. If there's no truth, how do you even know that is true? If someone claims there are no absolutes, how can you be absolutely sure that's true? And for all of postmodernism's claims of no absolutes, they're dogmatic about being right. They use reason, the very thing they say is invalid, to make their truth claims. And for all of their talk about tolerance, they preach intolerance toward anyone who doesn't believe their opinions. You know, I think this argument of postmodernism's contradictory nature is very helpful in addressing the movement, but only really as a side argument. In our Christian witness, I believe it's much more important that we argue from the standpoint that postmodernism is an excuse to justify rebellion against God. I believe that answer best exposes sin and convicts people's hearts. As I read the gospel, Jesus didn't tell his opponents that they were being irrational as much as telling them that they were playing intellectual games to cover their sin. But be that as it may, let's take a look at the rational inconsistencies of postmodernism. Hicks has an entire chapter on this. He writes, postmodernism uses contradictory discourse as a political strategy. On the one hand, all truth is relative. On the other hand, postmodernism tells it like it really is. On the one hand, all cultures are equally deserving of respect. On the other hand, Western culture is uniquely destructive or bad. Postmodernism teaches values are subjective, but sexism and racism are really evil. Postmodernism teaches technology is bad and destructive, and yet it's unfair that some people have more technology than others. Postmodernism teaches tolerance is good and dominance is bad, but when postmodernists come to power, political correctness follows. Postmodernism will teach egalitarianism and yet argue that nobody really knows the absolute truth. Here are some other inconsistencies. Postmodernism says that the West is deeply racist, but they know very well that the West ended slavery for the first time ever, and that it's only in places where Western ideals have made inroads that racist ideas are on the defensive. They say that the West is deeply sexist, but they know very well Western women were the first to get the vote, contractual rights, and the opportunities that most women in the world are still without. They say that Western capitalistic countries are cruel to their poorest members, subjecting them, getting rich off of them, but they know very well that the poor in the West are far richer than the poor anywhere else, both in terms of material assets and opportunities to improve their condition. So Hicks then goes on to give three possibilities to explain the hypocrisy of postmodernism. Number one, they truly believe in moral relativism, but their absolute politics is secondary. Number two, postmodernism is really about their totalitarian absolutism. Their talk about relativism is just a cover, a strategy to advance their politics of lawlessness. Number three, that relativism and absolutism can coexist in postmodernism, because if there's no truth, it doesn't matter if postmodernists decide to be dogmatic about their beliefs. In postmodernism, you can be your own god, you can make up your own rules, you can be true if you want to be true. Well, Hicks goes on to mostly support point number two as the main answer. For all of postmodernism's talk about there are no absolutes, they really believe in absolutes. And just think about this. Satan is an absolutist. He believes that he should be God. He believes he's right. But he will claim everything is relative to undermine the authority of God. Postmodernism is simply a way to call what we used to call evil right and what we used to call righteousness wrong. It's Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And this is what the ungodly do. They justify their actions with a philosophy, this philosophy called postmodernism. Quote, postmodernists use relativism, but do not believe it. And Hicks gives a really good example of how this works in argumentation. Suppose you're arguing politics and you're losing the debate. You're getting backed into the corner. The way to get your opponent off your back is to appeal to relativism. Now, we've all heard this before, where your opponent says, well, that's just a matter of opinion. Hicks writes, if your opponent accepts that the debate is a matter of opinion or semantics, then you're losing the argument doesn't matter. Nobody is right or wrong. But if your opponent does not accept that everything is a matter of opinion, then his attention is diverted away from the subject matter at hand, namely politics, into epistemology. For now, he has to show why everything is not merely semantic, and that's going to take him a while. Meanwhile, you have successfully diverted him, and if it looks like he's doing a good job on the semantic argument, you can throw in, well, what about perceptual illusions? In adopting this rhetorical strategy, do you really have to believe that everything is a matter of opinion or merely semantics? No, you do not. You can believe absolutely that you are right about the politics, and you can know that all you want to do is to use words to get your opponent off your back in a way that makes it seem like you have not lost the argument. Well, this kind of manipulation is very satanic. But some postmodernists have actually written about using this strategy to defeat traditional morality. The broader issue really is that the ungodly have been backed into the corner by God and by God's truth. And so their rationalization, their defense mechanism, is postmodern relativism. There is one more tactic that the Marxists use in addition to arguments of relativism, and I'm sure you know what it is. When confronted with their failed logic, as Hicks writes, when their irrational arguments are laughed out of court, they resort to violence. What do rebellious children do when they're confronted with the fallacies of their arguments? They cannot reason like adults. So what do? They throw a temper tantrum. And what do some grown adults do when they run out of arguments? They threaten to beat you up. And if there is no right and wrong, as taught in postmodernism, if there are no moral absolutes, if logic is simply made up by Western Europeans to secure power, then the only arbiter of right and wrong is power. If you want to do what you want to do and you want others to do what you want them to do, you just have to use power. Might makes right. And that is why so many activists on the left are resorting to Antifa-like violence, because since there are no morals and there are no values, you can only win by violence. Hicks concludes his book by boldly stating that postmodernism is really about power, envy, resentment, and destruction. It's about hate, the very thing they accuse the right of. Hicks quotes Nietzsche, "When some men fail to accomplish what they desire to do, they explain angrily, 'May the whole world perish.' This repulsive emotion is the pinnacle of envy, whose implication is, if I cannot have something, no one can have anything, no one can be anything." Remember Cain in Genesis chapter 3, the first leftist. He killed Abel out of resentment and envy. "If my offering is not accepted, it's not that I need to repent. I just need to turn around and kill my brother Abel." When backed into the corner, he resorted to violence. The postmodernist philosopher Foucault called for the destruction of the entire human race. And it's no surprise that the left is the culture of death. If God is dead, then man has to die also. Hicks also points out that the artist Duchamp had the attitude, "I cannot be the equal of the great artists. So instead, I will deface their works and turn it into a joke. I cannot be special unless I destroy your achievement first." Hicks also says it this way: postmodernism, then, in its most extreme form, is about making nothing reign, because these people hate all rule outside of themselves. And this is what is driving Satan and his followers: a bitter hatred against God, against his authority, because of their own desire for self-importance. And you can see this hatred in the eyes of the postmodern Marxist. So this is the Christian response to the philosophy of postmodernism, this age-old rebellion against God operating under new terms and new titles. And the message of Christ is to put down your sword, surrender to your Creator, and receive his salvation. Revelation chapter 22, the Bible ends with this invitation: "The Spirit and the bride say, 'Come,' and let the one who hears say, 'Come,' and let the one who is thirsty come, and let the one who wishes take of the water of life without cost. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Thank you for including God and Country as part of your discipleship in the Word. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button to lend moral support to the cause. Keep the faith. Stand firm in the faith. Be encouraged. Jesus Christ is Lord.